and it's 6 past the hour on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher, kings and queens, working class heroes, fellow animals of the world, frozen folks. How are you? New York, Boston, the entire eastern seaboard. Mark Riley, good morning.
Good morning.
Man, I didn't think I was going to get out of Boston, my friend.
I didn't think you were either, man. I was going to have to put Kayla on speed dial, have him substitute for you or something. But you're here.
I made it out. And you know what? I got to be honest with you. The people of Boston came out Saturday night.
They were
not deterred. They were not afraid. I'll tell you something else, man. But if you watch the TV broadcast, they did it down here, too. You would think that it was the end of the world. I mean, it's snow. Take it easy. I talked about that to the crowd in Boston. I mean, literally, you turn on the TV and you're like, oh, my God, don't go outside. You're going to need a water purifier. Be careful. Oh, God bless everyone. If we lose your signal, you're on your own. I couldn't believe it. It's winter. It's snow. Take it easy.
It's not the worst snow I've ever seen. And see, the further north you get in the United States, the better people seem to be able to cope with snow. Because when you go down south, go to Virginia, and watch what happens when there's like 3 inches of snow on the ground.
Oh, yeah,
people skidding into,
flying down the street.
Trees.
They have no way.
Flip it over.
No understanding of how to drive in it. Well, that's the amazing thing is that, they did a pretty good job here, it looked like, and up in Boston, they were plowing all night, but they got more up there. I mean, it was pretty much a snow emergency. There's no doubt about that. But the whole idea of, you better stock up for the week. I mean, they're on top of it. You know what I mean?
Oh, no, I stocked up for the day on Saturday when it started snowing, went to the local supermarket, gorilla the parking space because people were just like, people were getting ugly over parking.
It's unbelievable, though. It's sort of like, we got to get jerky, we got to get a water purifier, we might be in for a day.
Oh, no jerky, no water purifier, because I knew we were going to dig out the next day. The way it looked, I knew I was going to have a mammoth job to do because my wife doesn't dig snow.
How'd that do? How'd it go? Did you do all right?
Yeah, I mean, you know what I do?
Doing that.
I know. Every time I got a little dizzy, I stopped. So it was like, I'd say, 15-minute break. My daughter Vivica came out, and she really helped me a lot. Believe it or not, she cleaned off one of the cars.
Yeah.
And got us ready. So we actually went to church yesterday morning.
Yeah.
Drove in second gear all the way to church.
You got to be careful on the roads, but you got to be careful of shoveling that snow if it's the only exercise you get all year. Take it easy. You might want to have the kid down the street do it so you don't die.
I started to do it. Two kids walked by me with big shovels, right? Because yesterday I actually had to shovel the other car that I drive to work out.
Uh-huh.
Right? So, these two kids are out there, and I'm thinking, should I just, say how much to dig out the rest of it? Because it wasn't that much.
Yeah.
And I said, nah, I'll do it myself. And then they get like halfway down the street. I said, oh, no, let me call. Yo!
Yeah.
They never turned around. Yeah. They couldn't hear me.
They missed your opportunity.
That was it.
I'll tell you, I love the snow. I was excited about it. I mean, everyone was complaining. Everyone's like, well, then again, I'm not driving. I'm taking the train. I'm up in Boston. To me, my wife, Mishna, was up there with me. And when we saw that blizzard coming, it was like, wow, this is great.
Oh, the weather outside is frightful.
I love it. And, we went out there yesterday. We're dragging our suitcases to the T to get to South Station. It felt dramatic, Nanook, and it just felt like we were going. It was an important journey.
Well, that's the thing that to me separates cities like Boston, Philadelphia, D.C. from the rest of the United States, because they have subways that run almost no matter what.
Amtrak was on time pretty much. I mean, give or take an hour. A lot of trains, a few of them got canceled out of South Station. I was just thrilled that ours got made it through, and that was the only way to travel. I think yesterday
it was probably the only way to get
around. Wasn't driving, just got on the train. It took a little while, and there were some kids. This family with these kids, and usually this doesn't bother me. I'm really able to let it go, and it didn't drive me nuts. But when you get a couple of kids, three kids, I think they had this couple, and they just would not stop. And
were they running up and down the aisle?
No,
were they just
running
talking?
Down. It was a lot of this. A lot of making the noise, look at it, and one of them was like, I want it. And it was just like, it went on and on and on. And I sort of, I let it go, but there was a certain point where I'm like, you know, what do you do? And like, these.
Threaten.
Well, these parents.
Have you ever threatened a kid that's not your own?
But these parents, I mean, these parents were like in some sort of, you know, postpartum, you know, delusional kind of like, they just had no power, no control whatsoever. And like, the mother was just doing this ineffectual sort of like,
sit down.
No, but she just kept repeating it, and to no, there was no reaction to it. Just la 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 la, shh. It never stopped.
Well, you know what you do then.
What?
You turn the kid around when the parents aren't looking. Kid,
yeah.
If you make another sound, I'll kill you.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, that's it. That's good. Yeah.
Then I had a friend that did that once in a Roy Rogers. This one kid was running around sucking on all the ketchup bottles.
Yeah.
And he waited till the parents weren't looking, because parents made no effort to stop the kid.
Yeah.
So he looked at them and said, hey, kid, come here.
Yeah.
He said, you suck on another one of those bottles, I'm going to kill you.
Did that stop him?
Yep. You got to
be careful. That's when you are led away in handcuffs for being mean to kids.
Yeah, yeah.
But let's get into the sad reality is that Johnny Carson is dead.
At 79.
79, which, you know, is old, but not as old as he could have been, you know, had he not been sick. And, you know, but the
emphysema, right?
Yeah, yeah. I think he's had it for a while, you know. And the precursor to emphysema, of course, smoking.
Was that what it was?
Yeah, he was.
I never watched the Tonight Show. I'm at a complete loss when it comes to Carson's mystique. I do know that he provided entree to, like, a whole raft of comedians.
Well, you know what he was? He was a class act. He was a great broadcaster. He had a great humanity to him. He had a great a humility, a disposition, a way of interviewing that was very smooth. He always made his guests look good. He was very quick-witted. But the bottom line in my head, when I remember him, like, I never did The Tonight Show. It was a little before my time. And I watched it not as a kid so much. But, you know, I watched it later on, but I can't remember when I started watching it, probably in the 70s, late 70s. And then I actually watched Letterman after Carson when I was in college. But he was just a class act, you know. It was a little glitzy, you know, but it was, you don't see broadcasters like him. His whole generation seemed to be sort of disappearing. There's only a few left, and there's only a few young guys that actually do the type of broadcasting that he did. Like, if you look at Jay Leno, who I think is just a train wreck. He's a disaster. He's a... You know, he's a classless broadcaster. He just gets on and he just blusters his way through things. He's very, you know, he has no tact in interviews. He speaks over people. You know, he's very selfish. And, you know, you look at the Carson, even just looking at the reels today, you know, as they're paying tribute to him, you know, he never stole stage. He always, you know, let his guests shine. Yeah. And he was always very, it wasn't a matter of candid. It was like he just had... There was a vulnerability there. You know, he was a sweet presence.
Well, you know, one of the things that I do know, not having watched the show at all, but I do know that there was a seismic shift in the television industry when Carson decided to leave New York and go to Los Angeles.
That's a long time ago.
Yeah, it was. And at the time, all of that kind of television was being done here.
Yeah.
Carson's move precipitated a wholesale shift in the television business, so that so much more of it was done out of Hollywood than was done out of New York.
Well, Jack Parr, you know, if you go to the Museum of Broadcasting and watch some of those old Jack Parr broadcasts, that guy was a genius. That guy, you know, he used to just pull a stool out onto the Tonight Show stage, sit down, and just, you know, just shoot it. You know, just shoot the crap, you know. And then, you know, he'd have the way he conversed. Like, Carson, there was an interview that he did with Brian Gumbel, I guess, in the mid-'80s. That they were showing on TV, and that, you know, he said that there was no way he was going to follow Jack Parr. I mean, Jack Parr was this, you know, completely unique talent, and Carson said, you know, I had to get on there and take over and take the hit and just be who I was wait till it stuck, you know, which is sort of like the way we felt when we come on here. You know, I came onto this show, you know, not knowing really how to, you know, do the medium, not knowing whether we were going to be successful or not, but you just got to do it.
There you go.
And you got to wait and see what happens, but... Carson was just like I was saying before. I mean, Regis is still around. Letterman is certainly a legacy to Carson in terms of the style of broadcasting he did.
Yeah.
But, and I think even Jon Stewart has a certain amount of respect for broadcasting appropriately and being, you know, a class act. You know, and
that's,
I think,
the first good thing I've ever heard you say about Jon Stewart. Well, no, I'm only kidding.
Well, I was just trying to think, you know, about the legacy, because there is a way to be a broadcaster, and it was honored a lot more back then, you know.
Oh yeah,
and,
yeah.
And although, you know, Carson was very, you know, he was very a very great stand-up comedian. Actually, when he moved to L.A. from New York, he would go to the Comedy Store in the 70s and work out his monologues sometimes.
Yeah.
I mean, he had that much care for it, and he always had a tremendous respect for the sort of the job of the comedy. comic. And he was talking about that in that interview, too. It was very
Doug had a lot of good writers, from what I understand.
Great writers.
People that were that really knew him and knew what to write for him.
But it was the most important thing in the world to be on Carson. I guess we'll talk about it a little more after this, along with, I guess we're going to go finish up with Carson and then go to Iraq.
Ooh.
16 past the hour, Air America Radio.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your blog. MorningSedition.com. Courtesy of Air America Radio.
Past the hour. Good morning. It's Monday. It's snowing here. I don't know where you are. I'm Mark. It's not snowing. There's snow on the ground. I don't want to mislead anybody, but there is like at least 20 feet of snow here in New York. 20, 25 feet of snow. It was very. I had to make a tunnel to get here from Queens. A tunnel. There's a snow tunnel to get me home. So, look, I want to thank everyone who came out to the Jimmy Tingles Off-Broadway Theater on Friday and Saturday night. We had a good time in the middle of a blizzard. I held forth with about, 100 or so people there in Jimmy Tingles. We had a very nice conversation. Big fans of the show, Riley.
Yes.
Some woman just comes up to me and goes, "What do you have against the Black Crows?" And then so I was talking about my email addiction. And then someone says, "What does Riley do?" I'm like, "Riley doesn't do anything. He doesn't get himself involved with the email thing.
No,
he just walks right by it.
I'm
sitting there going, God, what is going on with these people? Hey, if you want to join the Morning Sedition Book Club, you can still purchase Sam Lipsight's Homeland by going to morningsedition.com. Sam's going to be back in the studio on January 28th. He's going to take calls, discuss the book. We're going to have a good time. A couple emails have already come in saying, Maron. I didn't want to believe you, but, I read Lipsight's book, and it was one of the first books that made me laugh out loud in public in a long time. Here, let me give you a taste. Oh, maybe not. All right. What? I was going to, yeah. So, anyways, if you want to get it, I'm telling you, it's a hilarious book, and he will definitely be here on the 28th. Also, Pashman's Picks on the morningsedition.com. We might be making that a live thing. We might have Dan Pashman, son of Lewis and Linda Pashman, come in weekly.
Weekly?
I just talked about cars for a minute.
Weekly. You sure it's going to be weekly?
Weekly, hopefully. And
could end up being daily, that.
Well, we're going to try and manage it.
Could be hourly if we're
I brought
careful.
Him a poster from Boston. I went to this little record store on Mass Ave.
It's okay.
Outside of Central Square, I got him the poster of Johnny Cash flipping us off. Because Pashman's a big guy. Yeah.
He's a big flip-off fan?
Yeah, yeah. Here's a little taste of Sam Lipsight.
Just turn to my intimate portraits page in the yearbook, and you'll see that I was never anything approaching buck-like. Not unless there's such a thing in nature as a buck turtle.
Very funny, man.
Mm.
Sam, and that's not even in context, but this book is about a relatively bitter, sort of, resigned person who never made of his life what he wanted to make of it, and he's using his high school newsletter letters, dispatches to his high school newsletter,
mm-hmm.
that are never going to be published as sort of his vent for his bile and his life. And it's comparable to Catcher in the Rye. It's comparable to some of the great sort of dark satirical writing of the 70s. And Sam's a real wordsmith. But you can get Homeland at morningsedition.com. Now, getting into, once again, rest in peace, Johnny Carson. This is a sad day for everybody who enjoyed The Tonight Show, for everybody who enjoys, that element of show business. He's really that era of entertainer is really they're all going that way, as will happen when people get old. But you watch some of those old clips, Riley, the camaraderie of what was once Hollywood you don't see it anymore. Even if they try to manufacture it with something like Ocean's 12 or whatever, even if they I don't know whether it's because people make too much money or they're too selfish or it's too competitive, but you watch some of the Carson shows and you're like, hey, all these guys got off on each other.
It seemed that way. I mean, Doc Severinsen made a career out of being the band leader for the Carson.
Well, like when Dean Martin or Rickles or, any of those old guard were on TV, Jimmy Stewart, all these cats, it just seemed like the pop culture was more unified. It was smaller. Everybody seemed to know each other. You got a feeling there was some camaraderie and there was a certain fun to show business. Where now you just get these weird, rich, robotic people that do strange things and seem incredibly self-involved. And they just I don't feel that camaraderie anymore.
I have a theory about why that is. Mm-hmm. And it has to do with the fact that everything and everybody is now their own niche market.
That's true. Branding.
So, yeah, everything is branding. And you're not aiming at the broad mass of the American public the way a lot of media did during that 50s, 60s, early 70s period, mm-hmm. when everybody was really about, you know, to everyone 12 years of age and older was considered a target.
I think that's a good point, Riley, because I think that at the time when there was only three or four major television outlets, it really, you know, what was defined as television, what was defined as print media was pretty intimate. It was all you had. That was the context of your media experience.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Now, of course, you've got 10 zillion different channels, you know, apparently created to appeal to 10 zillion different tastes. You know, you got 5 or 6 different black gospel channels on television. It never ceases to amaze me how much stuff, you know, there's 5 country music channels. There are all these different little niche markets. And I think it kind of takes away from the cohesion that's necessary to create the atmosphere that you're describing, where,
yeah.
you know, people knew each other. There was a genuine feeling of warmth among people. You know, one thing I have to say for Carson looked out for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just the young comics he gave a break to. I'm sounding like I actually watched the show. But he did, in fact, key people like Jimmy Stewart, for example.
Sure.
Kept his name out there. Rickles, these other guys who were not kids anymore, but enabled them to make a living doing other things, playing Vegas, playing these different, because he was on the, you know, they were on the Tonight Show.
Yeah, it made a difference. I mean, if you did the Tonight Show, you said where you were playing, people would show up. It's different now, and it is because of niche marketing. And a lot of the comics that are out on the road today, they generate a lot of their crowds by, you know, updating their websites, getting out there on a regular basis, developing followings. And it is a lot more difficult for someone to do that now. And I think it benefits the consumer on some level, or the person that is trying to find a certain type of entertainment, but it is more challenging for the performer, the author, or whatever it is, however you're trying to reach out to accumulate a real big following. It's much more competitive.
I got one beef with Johnny Carson.
Okay.
He gave Joan Rivers a break.
Ugh,
I've never liked Joan Rivers.
Yes, no, I have to agree with you there. And I don't know what, I'd really like to see the portrait of her in the attic that's rotting, because I don't know what the hell she is doing to her face. Or I think she just has some sort of strange knob on the back of her head that she just turns every couple of weeks and just pulls the face
tighter.
Yeah,
installed by a doctor who's probably making $1 billion off it.
That's right.
When we come back, Ray. Hey, Ray, how you doing, man? Well, we'll get to him. We got the Palm Pilot coming up. We're going to be talking Iraq in great detail with Bobby Ghosh, and he's from Time Magazine. He's going to give us a lowdown from overseas.
Yeah.
When we come back here on Air America Radio.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley, Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Before past the hour, Mark Maron here. That's Mark Riley.
Yes, it is.
You're listening to Morning Sedition. It's Monday. And, for some reason, Ramon came in and he was wearing some, like, you know, those old style, like, you know, headphones that had remote controls on the outside.
Yeah.
They used to have come with a stereo back in the 70s. He had those on. They were plugged into something in his backpack. I have no idea what's going on with that guy. But here's Michael Powers, Palm Pilot, for this morning. 6:30 a.m. Get into FCC office before everyone else. Quietly remove hidden toilet cans. 7:30 a.m. Clear out desk. Andrew Dice Clay box set. 2 live crew bootlegs. Toilet cam videos. 8:30 a.m. Monitor AM radio for danger words. Focaccia. Shih Tzu. Country ham. Succotash. Kumquat. 12 noon. Have lunch with Howard Stern. Congratulate each other on the greatest public relations fake feud of all time. 2 p.m. Work with Dad on Vaudeville Act called Bush's Biatch. Carrying W's water. 4 p.m. Call Comedy Central. Agree to be guest of honor at Friars Club Roast. And 6 p.m. Hit the deregulate button and run. There you go. So we are going to be talking to, in a few moments, there's a lot of stuff going on. Well, not a lot of stuff, but the election's coming up in Iraq.
Counting down to the election. And it's getting stranger and stranger as the count gets closer.
We're going to talk to Bobby Ghosh in just a second about, you know, what exactly is going on with the election. Are there going to be people watching the election? And what about Chalabi? Yeah. Right now, from Baghdad, we have, from Time Magazine's Baghdad Bureau, we have Bobby Ghosh. Welcome to the show. Now, what is going on with
I'm not sure he's up yet, but he is now.
Oh, is he there now?
Yes, he's there.
Good morning.
Yes, I am.
Okay, Bobby Ghosh, what is going on with Ahmed Chalabi, and is he wanted in every nation in the Middle East?
not quite, Mark, but he certainly is still that ancient warrant outstanding for him in Jordan, and his political rivals here are sort of using that as a hammer to hit at him or hit back at him. What happened in the latest kerfuffle is that he accused the defense minister here, Dahlan, of stealing some money from the Iraqi Central Bank, and the defense minister basically got back at him by saying, "You're a fine one to talk with your background in having this outstanding warrant for embezzlement," and he threatened to hand Ahmed Chalabi over to the Interpol. Now, it's all pre-election politics as usual, except that it's not as usual in Iraq. So for Iraqis, this is very fascinating and very new.
Now, why didn't he just sue him for defamation instead of threatening to have him arrested and handed over to Interpol?
Well, before you can sue people for defamation, Mark, you need to have a credible legal system. They don't have one just quite yet. Look at how much trouble they've been having trying to get Saddam Hussein's trial going. They still don't have a full complement of lawyers, of judges, court clerks, the works. I think it'll be many years before Iraqis start suing each other for defamation.
So you say that this is sort of a campaigning tactic, a political tactic. What is that? What does the political campaigns look like in Iraq right now? Is Alawi out, you know, speaking to people? Are there posters up? What's it look like there?
Well, it looks like no election campaign you ever saw. There are very few candidates out and about pressing the flesh to kissing babies because it's far too dangerous to do that. What they are doing is sort of compensating for that by basing the whole city or anyway, large parts of Baghdad and other cities with election posters. And Alawi himself is using his financial muscle to pay for a lot of TV advertising, and that gives him a bit of a leg up, apart from the fact that, of course, as the incumbent, he's on TV a lot anyway.
Bobby, when you talk about the
Iraqis are fascinated.
Bobby, when you talk about the money that Alawi's using, there seems to be some question about where that money is coming from. Are those questions resounding among the potential voters? Are they wondering where he's getting the money to advertise on TV?
I'm sure a few people are, but, you know, that same question can be levied at almost any political group here. Where does the money come from? The laws that govern this country, the law that was written during the first months after the end of the war, says that you cannot get foreign funding for your ads. But I think it's generally accepted that a lot of the money for all the political parties, not just Alawi, is coming from their supporters abroad, from neighboring countries, Iran, Saudi Arabia, the Jordan, and Syria, and also from the sizable expatriate Iraqi community abroad.
So tell me a little bit about this fascination on behalf of the Iraqi people in the election process. How is that revealing itself?
Well, people just can't get enough. I mean, they're talking about it all the time, and it's on TV all the time. The debates are sort of hot and furious. It's amazing because they're seeing for the first time what a real election campaign is like. You have to remember that for the past 30 years, the only thing they've had is sort of every 4 years they've had to go to their voting booths to choose between Saddam Hussein and Saddam Hussein. So it's a big deal for them that they now have 111 political parties. They don't even know what these political parties stand for. They don't necessarily know who all the candidates are, but they're just tickled pink that is going on, that is happening around them.
Now, there's a lot.
Let me just finish. There are Sunni people who don't like the election at all. Think that just because it's being It's taking place under occupation by a foreign military force. It's not really legitimate, but they are definitely a minority. The vast majority of Iraqis are very excited by this. They have some trepidations, but on the whole, they're very excited.
So now you're talking about the Sunni population who are somewhat, some of them are involved in the resistance, as are jihadists, there was a report that Zarqawi has released a new tape to, you know, threatening the election. We've got reports here that there's not going to be any, you know, international monitoring the elections. What do you really feel the elections are going to prove? Are they going to be legitimate in any way in terms of the numbers of people that will vote and represent the Iraqi populace?
Well, Mark, even in the worst-case scenario, the election will produce a government that is a lot more legitimate than the one you have now. The government you have now comprises of politicians who were appointed by an occupying power. So whatever the election produces, it will produce some expression in some degree or the other of the will of the Iraqi people. Now, there is a very good chance that the turnout will be very low because of these threats that Zarqawi and other groups have made to disrupt the election. I'm sure a lot of Iraqis on election morning will be looking at themselves and looking at their loved ones and asking whether it's really worth taking the risk to go out and vote. But I think most people here accept that the fact that there is going to be an election at all is a big victory for Iraq. And even if the turnout is low, that is truly how this election is measured. It should be measured by the fact that an election is taking place at all, and that most Iraqis who are willing to participate have the right to do so.
Bobby Ghosh is our guest. We are talking to him live from Baghdad. He's senior editor and correspondent at Time Magazine. Bobby, last week during Condoleezza Rice's confirmation hearings as Secretary of State, there was a glaring difference between how many Iraqi security forces she said were trained, 120,000, and the number that one of our United States Senators, Joe Biden, said were trained, which was only 4,000. You're in Baghdad. Which one of these numbers is right?
Both of them are right, Mark. It depends on how you define training. There's training and then there's training. A lot of the Iraqi police force and a lot of the Iraqi military divisions have only this sort of slightest bit of training. No army or police force in the world would hire them on the basis of the kind of training they've got. There's a very small number of people in say the special forces, the commandos, who have got the kind of training that any army would expect from its soldiers. But the fact is, you know, it's awfully hard to train an entire army in a couple of years. And I think Dr. Rice was being a little bit disingenuous when she put the number that high. I think we should recognize that whereas there may be 110,000 people who have certificates of some kind saying that they're trained, that doesn't necessarily mean that they know the front end of a gun from the back.
Right. Bobby Ghosh, let me ask you one more question about the, you know, that the Sunnis are involved in the resistance in what's being called the insurgency. Now, are they afraid in post-election that they are going to be marginalized by a Shia majority, or are they just basically instigating a civil war that could go on for who knows how long?
Well, I think we should point out that only a small sliver of the Sunni population is involved in the resistance. Those who are don't care one way or the other what happens after the election. From their point of view, the election is illegal and doesn't have any legitimacy, so the results have no bearing on their plans. The vast majority of Sunnis are indeed very concerned about what happens after the election, because this government, the parliament that's elected by this election, gets to decide the constitution that Iraq will follow for years to come. And Sunnis are very keen that their voices should be heard in the writing of that constitution. And the Shia and other ethnic groups here are trying to be conciliatory and trying to say that even if there are a lot of Sunnis elected in parliament, we're going to make sure that there are enough prominent Sunnis in prominent government positions and that the Sunnis get involved in the writing of the election, of the Constitution.
Well, thank you.
Whether all of this will happen is anybody's guess.
Right. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Bobby Ghosh. It's nice to talk to you, and be careful.
We appreciate you.
That's Bobby Ghosh. He is Baghdad Bureau Editor. Bureau Editor-Chief.
Senior Editor and Correspondent.
Brain skid, man. Brain skid day. What are we doing?
No, man, I had one. We all have. We go through that. But no, Bobby Ghost was senior Editor and Correspondent for Time Magazine. He was live in Baghdad. We heard, you know, the line went in and out a little bit.
We talked to McWare a lot, but I guess he's embedded with the insurgents.
Yes.
We're going to take some calls. What's on your mind out there about anything? 866-303-2270, non-specific call segment. I'm sure we'll find something to talk about after the break. We have plenty of things. But
digging out of the snow? Call us.
Yeah, that's fine. Also, like next this week, too, later in the week, we're going to talk to Noah Feldman about what the government is going to look like in Iraq as we move more towards the election. So we hope to hear from you in a second. If not, we'll talk to ourselves here. That's not an issue. It's 46 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Join the morning sedition. Right now, call 866-303-2270.
What?
That's 866-303-2270.
You don't know until you've tried this.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Damn good.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
Made it through the blizzard.
Yeah.
Made it back home from Boston. There was like 50 feet of snow in Boston. Fell in 2 days. 50 feet. It was unbelievable.
Filled up the whole big thing.
Oh, my God. It was like that movie. What was that horrible movie? What was
Day
that? The Day After Tomorrow. Yeah.
Oh.
It was awful. Everything froze up. You know, the whole city's covered with snow. And we made it out, my wife and I, Mishna. We dug a tunnel and up over the top. We had some dog sleds pulling our bags.
And got right into the Acela.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, here we go. Let's take a call. You know what? My brain is like just starting to come around a little bit. Ron in California, what's going on?
What's up, Ron?
Hey, man. Listen, Mark. And Mark, we got to hip ourselves. You're just the three of us here talking, right? Nobody's listening?
No, no one's listening.
Not a soul.
I've been dragging my butt around for about, 40 years, a little over, as a sort of like radical, then somehow the word progressive got stuck in. But
yeah.
Iraq is gone. It's finished. It's a disaster. There was no infrastructure. You heard the cat talking about the legal system.
We did, yeah.
It's gone. Nothing. Zero.
Yeah.
Zip.
Yeah.
We had an election here. What happened? Nothing. Zero. Zip.
Right.
It's like Gandhi said, you know, somebody asked him, what do you think about Western civilization? His answer, it's a good idea. So that's kind of the way I feel about Iraq and democracy and election. It just ain't going to happen. And we're going to be there for God knows how long because of the oil.
Yeah.
It's just.
You got any hope, Ron? You got any hope?
Come on, Ron. Give us a little hope.
The hope is to get the blue collar in this country. We need real working class intellectuals speaking on Air America. I mean, guys who actually are truck drivers and plumbers and intellectuals and who study the Constitution.
Right. We haven't had any plumbers. We get a couple of truck drivers. Well,
yeah, we got a bunch of truck drivers.
Well, we're going to get some badass tough guys who know the Constitution and refuse to leave it alone. That's our only hope, that little piece of paper.
A piece of parchment.
That is being now used for toilet paper.
Exactly. Well, Ron, I appreciate your call, and we're reaching out to intellectual plumbers. It's 866-303-2270.
Hey, I used to be a postal clerk. Does that make me a
well, you're
class?
On the air right
working
But I don't want to show you what Ron is saying. Ron is saying that, you know, he's saying that the jig is up in Iraq, and the jig is up might be applied to this country as well, unless we get, you know, regular people back into the fold of the Democratic Party and back into the fold of people who believe in the Constitution and, you know, aren't willing to dissolve it, you know, in the name of Jesus or in the name of fear.
Well, you know, we got somebody that's in the process of doing both, and I don't know how he's going to be stopped if the Democratic Party doesn't stand up.
Yeah. Anyways, I like anybody who uses the word cat without being, you know, at all ironic about it. And for the rest of the day, I'm going to do this. We've got, I wouldn't even know how to pronounce his name.
Jacobus, I think.
Who's a cat from Minneapolis calling from KSNB. He's listening to KSNB. What's up, Jacobus?
Hey, how you doing?
What's up? Pretty good, man.
Well, I can't believe I'm on. Hey, thanks a lot, you guys. I used to be in, are you in New York?
Yeah, yes. We're here.
Okay,
Don't let that freak you out there.
Yeah.
What's going on,
I was,
man?
I was in New York.
Yeah.
I was in the Moonies.
No.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. But I'm out now.
Okay. Can I ask you a
question? Did you used to stay in that hotel over on 8th Avenue?
The New Yorker.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I was there from, let's see, 73 to 78.
Oh, you were there during the, what is that, News World? Was that the name of this paper?
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that.
All right, a couple questions, Jacobus. Am I pronouncing it right?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, why'd you get into the Moonies, number one? And while you were in the Moonies, you know, what was your job? And then when did the crap hit the fan?
Yeah, you know, I think at
that
point,
three questions.
Like,
yeah.
A lot of people joined all those cults because you know, it was kind of after the hippie thing. And I was definitely a hippie, but I you know, it just was like instantly. It's a kind of a cop out because, you know, all of a sudden you have all these answers and, you know, kind of feel a place. And
yeah.
You're part of this big crowd and they're
sure.
all singing songs.
Sure.
It was, you know, it was more reflective of the actual culture anyway. And
so was it the songs that got you?
What, sorry?
The songs?
Yeah, all kind of stupid songs. We'd co-op a lot of songs and write our own, and a lot of Korean songs, and
oh, wow.
A lot of Japanese people. I mean, there was a Korean-based kind of church, but it was a heck of a
lot. So it had an exotic appeal as
Did
well.
Did you ever get married? Were you one of those people that was at Madison Square Garden?
I left right before.
Oh, see?
I continued that pattern to this day.
So you're a bachelor, huh?
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
You missed the big party. Who knows?
Yeah.
That might have been the payoff.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you got out and you feel better?
Oh yeah. I mean, in the 20 whatever some years I have a daughter and she's my best friend, and you know, we're, you know, I'm politically educating myself through the prism of my experience.
That's very nice, man. And you're not in a cult anymore.
No.
Good.
I'm in your cult.
Well, thank you very much.
Good.
Appreciate your call. We got a fax coming in. You take care of yourself.
Thanks, man.
Thanks for calling.
So you got a cult, O'Marin?
Yeah, but I'm still sort of leaning towards doing a piece on the Moonies. We haven't done that yet, but there's still something fascinating about it.
Yeah.
All right, here's a liberal agenda for today. Here we go. New chairman of the SFS. New chairman of the FCC, Larry Flint. Two, praise Donald Trump for his wife recycling program. Three, make effort to keep secret SpongeBob's recent appearance at GLAAD and ACT UP meetings. Four, now that Bush's second term is underway, let's forge as many documents as possible. Five, today's phrase is dropping in the conversation. 2 days into Bush's second term and we get 15 inches of snow. Do the math, sheeple. He'll stop at nothing. Wake up!
Yeah. In the next hour, you know, they're trying to stop Howard Dean, Mark Maron. We're going to have to talk about it.
Jumpstart my brain.
Well, don't worry about it. It's not on autopilot.
All right.
We're also going to talk to the managing editor of The Hill,
yep. We'll talk
Bob
to him.
Cusack, and we're going to find out what's going on. Condi Rice is going to be debated and all that good stuff, so we're going to find out about that.
Yep.
And a lot more here on Air America Radio. Go nowhere.
You're listening to Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
Hi, I'm Mark Maron. You're listening to Air America Radio at 6 past the hour. And this is Morning's Edition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor. Good morning, constitutional plumbers. Good morning, constitutional He-Man. Our buddy Ron in California is telling us to reach out to the tough working class
truckers,
intellectual people, constitutional believers,
and scholars.
Yes. Good morning to all of you. Good morning to the shut-ins and the snow-ins. I was up in Boston over the weekend, and I have not seen that kind of snow in a long time. I don't think my wife has ever seen that kind of snow.
Really?
Yeah, we had a great time. Went out and bought some good socks, bought some long underwear, and went out and had fun.
Had fun out in the snow?
See, I don't know. Maybe I'm a child, but I don't panic. You know, I don't panic when I see that kind of snow. I was watching TV. You would have thought that it was the end of the world up there. Even Bloomberg got on TV here. He's like, this is dangerous. It's bad news.
Be careful.
Don't go outside.
Call 311.
Yeah, well, I just was like, great. Everything stops, and I get to go out and play. But then I felt bad for the guys who got to plow all night, because they were at it all night long, plowing that stuff. I think, it snowed a lot longer up in Boston.
Well, here in New York, they put the sanitation department, who are the people that actually do the plowing, on, I believe it was 2 12-hour shifts. So
yeah,
they were working from, you know, can't see in the morning to can't see at night. And I must say, their results are pretty evident on the streets. They're not bad. They're not as bad as I thought they were going to
be. There's a few more cops at South Station. I noticed some more cops around at Penn Station, too. Maybe they got a little nervous, you know, with the snow, something bad would happen. But I don't know. I just noticed that there was a pretty heavy police presence.
Well, was that because
they knew
Marc Maron was coming back from Boston?
Well, we all know that the terrorist threat in Boston with the four Chinese people and the snowstorm had something to do with stifling my turnout at Jimmy Tingle's Off-Broadway Theater, where despite that...
It didn't work!
That strategy put in place by the secret black ops that are now working under Donald Rumsfeld in the Pentagon.
Ooh, we're going to get to that story, too.
The strategic secret super service agency. It didn't work, man. People still came out. People came out on the night of the blizzard. We had a wonderful little time. We held court. We did a little talking. I did an hour and a half of stand-up both nights, a little longer, actually, on Friday night.
No, wait. Stop there for a second.
What?
Put a bookmark in it.
All right, bookmark.
An hour and a half of stand-up.
Yes, sir.
Now, that sounds like, you know, dreaming the impossible dream. So you riffed, essentially, for an hour and a half.
I did some riffing. I did some classics.
Really?
Yeah, because I one thing I realized about Boston, and they just got on board here in the first month, and, you know, a lot of them are not familiar with my stand-up work. Some, you know, it was funny. Some kid on Saturday night, like, I'm doing some jokes, and he's sitting there, and, you know, I said some comment to him. He's going, I'm just waiting for some new stuff. And I'm like, well, how dare you? How dare he?
I'm waiting for some new stuff.
He felt bad, though. I guess, well, he's a fan, which is fine. But, you know, I mix it up. I did a lot of new stuff. I had to do an hour and a half. And on Friday night, it was a little longer. Did some riffing with the audience. Friday night was kind of an improvisational adventure. Yeah, I sucked them right down the pipe of Marin. Do you understand?
I understand.
We do a little politics. What I'm trying to do is mix it up a little more efficiently. I'm going to have to structure some more bits specifically about my nuanced understanding of the political realities. Because, yeah, it used to be Riley. I'm telling you. That's what I said to the Boston Phoenix up there in Boston. I said, you know, on some levels, doing this show has ruined me. Yeah, because I used to make these. Yeah, I still make pretty broad generalizations, pretty reactionary sort of rants.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I definitely know more than I used to, so I can't speak stupidly about certain things, you know, without, you know, being taken to task by the little man in my head that says you're better than that dude. You know about this.
You know
stuff.
More now.
You can't pretend that you don't know this stuff.
I got a question.
Uh huh.
How drunk do people get at these kinds of comedy shows? Because I've only been to a couple. I've been to some comedy shows out in San Francisco, and I was surprised at how sober the audience was, to tell you the truth.
Well, this was a theater, and I didn't give them an intermission. Jimmy wanted me to give them an intermission, kind of, and I said,
but
no.
Hell no.
I'd rather not, because then I got to start all over again. If I'm in a good groove, what do I want to stop for? But he was under the assumption that I might have had a structure that I was working from, and perhaps could look at the outline of my structure and go, okay, there, we'll take the intermission. I'll just come back with this, but... No, he does not realize how I work. I go on stage, I bring everything I've ever written in my life in a stack with me, just about. Just to sit there and look at it, just to know that it's there. I don't refer to it much, other than to say that it's all there.
No, but, you just bring it.
So there wasn't a lot of people, wasn't too many drunks there. It depends on what night it is. Depends, you know, a lot of times, second show Friday, second show Saturday, it can get kind of ugly. Those are the babysitting shows. At some point Friday, you know... Saturday,
people get paid on Friday night.
But Saturday used to be the good night. Fridays are usually, it's hard to generalize, but, you know, when you do a club, you don't know what you're going to get into. If there's a small contingent of drunk folks, they can ruin it for everybody, or sometimes they loosen up and it can be kind of fun.
Mm.
But not as fun as this. A 40-year-old woman.
Oh, no, you're going to this.
Arvada, Colorado. Dude, I mean, it's like, it's not politics, but it's important because, I don't even know if it's important, but... A 40-year-old woman held sex and drug parties with teenage boys, telling police she wanted to be a cool mom.
Yeah.
A cool mom.
Not a soccer mom.
I know.
Cool mom.
Look, when I was in high school, you know, I had sexual fantasies about my friends' mothers. Come on, didn't we all? Of course. You know? And also, yes, you did. And I got to be honest with you, some of them are still in my rotation.
Oh.
Now, here we go. Moving on. We're not going to get too crass. All right? But if I had known, if I had ever had the opportunity... You know, I mean, it would have just blown my brains out. It would have just, it was like, it would have been the biggest gift that could have ever been given to me. And dig this. Sylvia Johnson allegedly provided marijuana, methamphetamine, and alcohol to 8 boys at parties held at her suburban Denver home in 2003-2004. She admitted having sex with 5 of the boys. So she's getting these kids high on crank
And she has a 62% success rate.
And booze, 62%. Yeah, that's not too good.
I know. Right, you got them all liquored up and stuff. What's up?
But she just, this is so sad in a way. Johnson told investigators she was not popular in high school, and she finally started feeling one of the group.
Literally.
Yes. She described herself as a cool mom. She didn't, the authorities do not say how many children she has. But, as sad as that story is and as disturbing as it is, I would have loved that. When I was in high school, I would have loved it.
How much time? If you were Judge Marin, how much time would you give Sylvia Johnson of Arvada, Colorado?
I think she's got to do community service. Non-sexual community service.
Non-sexual community. Yeah, I think she may be doing some time. But, if she admits to the methamphetamine and the marijuana, she could do some drug possession time.
Yeah, she's probably going to do some time.
Yeah.
And she just wanted to be a cool mom. She just wanted to be part of the group.
Yeah, yeah. Well, then, see, this is what happens when you're not popular in high school.
So what do you think of this, Riley? You think that they're going to, congressional Democrats will okay a constitutional amendment allowing naturalized citizens like California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger to run for president if Republicans help kill the 22nd Amendment barring third terms? Look at this quid pro quo thing.
This is just some beltway buzz. There has been a move afoot among some Republicans to actually change things so Arnold could run. The Democrats are just coming back with a rejoinder, and it's making the rounds among the different political consultants and people. But it's not going to happen. It will. I'm saying the third term thing will not happen.
Wouldn't that be amazing to see Bill Clinton kick W's butt? I mean, wouldn't that be amazing if he could come back? If he could come back and I'll show you how it's done.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he would, man. He would.
Who is he going to make... Who's he going to make the head of the DNC, I wonder?
Hey, that's a good question. You know what? We'll talk about it when we come back. It's 14 past the hour, Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here on Monday morning. We're snowed in. Snowed in here at Air America Radio. That's Mark Riley.
I'm snowed in, too.
We're all snowed in. The water's not working up here. That's kind of bumming me out.
Yeah, especially if you got to go to the bathroom.
Hey, hey, hey!
It is what it is.
Sorry. I just went, hey, hey, and went right into Fat Albert. Yeah, I remember that show. Now it's a movie. No one went to see that movie, I don't think. Did anyone go see that movie?
What?
The Fat Albert movie?
Is there one?
Yeah. Oh, man.
I don't know.
Here's my dream diary from last night. I'm backstage at Jimmy Tingle's Theater during a snowstorm. The good news, the house is packed. The bad news, it's packed with terrorists.
Oh, God.
Militia, good old boys, Mexican banditos, Arab jihadists, militant Zionists, neo-Nazi skinheads with swastikas tattooed on their necks, Klansmen and South American drug lords and IRA soldiers and the Weather Underground, some Black Panthers and three Korean guys wearing berets. And sitting in back was Bin Laden drinking a Pepsi. Tough room. I said, Jimmy, what's going on out there? Jimmy says, hey, sorry, Mac. I guess I shouldn't have put that terrorist drink 2-for-1 sign out front. So I go on stage, which shouldn't be ticking, but it was. And I say, hey, how's everybody doing? And the jihadists start chanting and fire some shots into the ceiling. And the neo-Nazi throws his beer and screams, entertain me, Jew! And the Black Panther yells, step off, cracker! And John Wilkes Booth pulls out his pistol and yells, death to tyrants! Then a couple of skinheads carrying axe handles start stomping toward the stage, and I'm thinking maybe now isn't the best time to go into my act. Way too political. So I open my mouth and I start singing. It's Over the Rainbow. And in my dream, I sound exactly like Judy Garland. Good thing, too, because almost immediately the terrorists put their guns away, sat down, and listened. And by the time I got to, if happy little bluebirds fly beyond the rainbow, why can't I? The entire room was dead silent except for the sound of 3 or 4 hate mongers blowing their noses. I could see Bin Laden wiping his eyes. The terrorists made me do 10 encores, all show tunes, including a Marlena Dietrich medley. Afterwards, two guys gave me flowers, and one of them his phone number. The stage blew up 10 minutes later, but no one could say I didn't kill. Yeah. I woke up and my bed was filled with groups claiming responsibility for the attack.
Oh, my goodness. Nobody said you didn't kill.
That's right. Who is that dream? What is that music? It's Ween, right? That's an interesting... Those guys are trippy. Ween. My wife's stepbrother is like a Ween fanatic.
Ween fanatic?
Yes. Has bootleg videos of Ween, has all of their records. Like, and he's just Ween
crazy.
How
many is all there?
They got a lot of stuff out. They're like psychedelic. They're a weird couple of guys that do a lot of interesting stuff. They kind of definitely, the beat of their own drummer is to say the least.
Ah.
You know, they just, they've got this cult following, and they do a lot of psychedelic stuff. They do R&B stuff. They do pop stuff. They're sort of all over the map, and they're very, they're very creative guys. So now, look, Howard Dean should be the guy, I think. I want him to be the guy. A lot of people would disagree with me. There are seven guys at this that are going to be DNC chair that are up for it.
Yeah.
And I just think, like, I don't care what anybody says. I think that he's got the passion and the fury and the nads to bring in new people, to reinfuse the base, whoever hasn't been reinfused yet by him. And actually reach out to some other people. Tap into the anger. You got to tap into the anger. You got to help that. What, as Ron was saying, as our caller before, the cat from San Francisco, or wherever he was calling from, said we've got to find those, you know, constitutionally oriented intellectual plumbers. We got to find the anger again of the working class. And I think that Dean is the guy to tap into that. But there's a lot of resistance, right, Riley?
There is, as there was during the campaign. And anybody but Dean movement that is seeking to block this man from being chair of the DNC.
Mm-hmm.
The leading person to be the alternate to Howard Dean, or the alternative to Howard Dean, is Martin Frost, the former congressman from Texas, who was our friend Barney Frank's choice.
Yeah.
Back when we were up in Boston, he said Martin Frost was the guy he was backing for the post. See, my thing is, at a point, you have to start asking yourself whether or not the existing strategy is ever going to work for you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? It didn't work in 2000 due to circumstances perhaps beyond its control. It certainly did not work in 2004, so you got to ask yourself, is this kind of centrism, you're part of the base message, going to work in 2008 when the seat is open?
Right. Will you tell me, Mark Riley, what exactly are the jobs? What do they have to do? What is the DNC chair? What is his responsibility?
The DNC chair's responsibility has kind of shifted over time. One of the big things for the DNC chair is to really be the catalyst for raising money,
mm-hmm.
to be the one that has his fingers on all of the donors' wallets, as mm-hmm. it were. And make sure that the party is well lubricated with dollars.
So that would be one of the primary fears with Dean, because he's a loose cannon. They're afraid he's going to alienate donors. The people that are willing to put a lot of money in, they're going to be afraid that he's taking the party too far to the left, and he's not going to be able to bring them all together.
But see, now MoveOn.org, mm-hmm. in its polemic of not too long ago, which of course Barney Frank also reacted to, said, look, there was $300 million raised by just plain folks,
right.
who are not beholden to corporate interests, who are not the usual Democratic Party donors. And it was MoveOn.org's contention that, hey, we funded the Democratic effort in 2004. We can fund it again, and therefore there's no reason not to back Howard Dean.
Right. And also, I guess, I imagine you have a bunch of Democrats who are afraid to be in relationship with Dean. They're afraid that, you know, that he's going to press them or put them or call them out or push them in a direction that they may not want to go in because they're wussies, right?
Well, see, part of it, Mark, is that they're wussies about the following. Right now, the chair of the DNC is going to be the most visible national Democrat. It's not going to be Bill Clinton. His time is kind of sort of come and gone.
Yeah.
There are a bunch of people that want to contest in 08, none of whom are at this point the titular head of the party, the alpha person of the party. The fact of the matter is the DNC chair is going to be the visible face of the party, at least through next year's off-year elections.
Is there some talk of them splitting the role in two?
That's not going to happen.
Well, what does that mean? What would the two roles be? Someone just for money and somebody for passion and ideology?
They would let Howard Dean be the chair, but there would be his role would be severely curtailed in favor of a general chairman who would be in the visible face of the party, which is what they're afraid of with Howard Dean. You know what? Sometimes you got to face your fears and go with them. And at this point, I don't know that there's anybody. I don't know Martin Frost all that well, but mm-hmm. I do know that in the cold, hard light of day, he lost the congressional election.
Yeah.
That's not exactly the greatest recommendation. Well, I don't know why Wellington Webb's candidacy isn't seen more seriously. You know, it's not, you know, that I reflexively support the brothers or the sisters.
Yeah.
But the fact is, he's a black candidate. He's a knowledgeable guy. Yeah, he had some union problems, but you can smooth over anything in politics.
Mm-hmm.
He's a former mayor of Denver, which means he had to balance budgets. Maybe they're afraid that, you know, people won't open their wallets for black people, but that wasn't true with Ron Brown.
Right.
So what's wrong with Wellington Webb? How come he's not one of the front runners here? And I'm not saying that he should be an anybody but Dean person. I think, you know, a competition is a great thing, and if Dean's got the votes, so be it. What is it, 477 people are actually voting that
yeah.
are members of the DNC?
And we're going to talk to a few of them, I know that. But the guys who are running and is Martin Frost, Simon Rosenberg, Kim Romer. Martin Frost was a former Texas congressman. Simon Rosenberg, former founder of the Centrist New Democrat Network. Tim
yeah.
Romer, former Indiana congressman. Donnie Fowler, he's a Democratic Party strategist. Wellington Webb, the mayor of Denver, former. David Leland, former Ohio Democratic Party chairman.
Yeah, they all got their pluses, they all got their minuses, but Howard Dean looks like the man for now. We're going to be right back. We're going to find out about a little...
Gonzalez, Torquemada
Gonzalez.
And his dirty past.
He's got more problems than the torture stuff, that's
mm-hmm.
for sure. When we come back here on Air America Radio...
Mark Maron and Mark Riley, Mornings Edition on Air America Radio.
Hey, 34 past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
Morning Sedition, Air America Radio. Thank you, Boston, for coming out. It's very nice to see everybody over the weekend. Thank you, God, for the snow. Oh, that would go against everything I believe in. Thank you,
Freudian slip.
Great eternal coincidence for the snow. We're going to talk to Bob Cusack in just a second. He's a managing editor of The Hill. We're going to talk about what's going on that hill down there south of here in Washington. And now, we know a lot of people out there are out of work and spent your Sunday leaping through the want ads or monster.com. We want to help. Be part of the solution, not part of the problem. So here's our Morning Sedition Monday Help Wanted listing. Poll workers needed for Iraqi election. Have you always dreamed of risking your life and the lives of your family in order to validate the imperial pretensions of a spoiled and dim-witted child of privilege who lives worlds away? Then check out the fast-paced, anything-can-happen new world of Iraqi elections. Plenty of positions are available, with more openings occurring every day. Successful applicants will be expected to make up for the most powerful nation on Earth's lack of planning. Responsibilities include surviving long enough for us to figure out what the other responsibilities are. This job includes health benefits. Specifically, we will try to stop any profuse bleeding until we can drag your twitching body out of sight. To apply, simply approach U.S. military headquarters in your district, but not in a vehicle. Walk with hands in plain sight and drop to the ground when ordered. We are an equal opportunity employer. That's our job listing for today. Now, we're going to get Bob Cusack on the phone here. We're going to talk about this. We're going to talk about Alberto Torquemada Gonzalez's past, Mark Riley.
Absolutely.
Apparently, he stepped to Bush's side not just once or twice, but you know many times. And in one particular instance, the governor, the then governor of Texas, was called on for jury duty. His number came up.
His number came up, and the question of whether or not he actually wanted to serve is a very open one.
Right, and not just whether he wanted to serve, but, you know, what about his past? Why didn't he want to serve? What would it imply serving? You know? Yeah, okay, right now it's great to have he's a regular guest here on the show. He's managing editor of The Hill. Please say hello to Bob Cusack. Good morning, Bob.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, good morning, guys.
How you doing?
So are you hip to this story about Gonzalez, trying to get George the Weasel out of jury duty because of a drunk driving rap?
I've heard a little bit about that, and obviously a lot of the senators have some major concerns with Gonzalez, and that they didn't already approve him. And it's the first sign, along with the postponement of the Senate approving Rice, Condoleezza Rice, that It's going to be a rough ride. Democrats are definitely drawing a line in the sand on these nominations, which will go through, but they're not making it easy.
Now, it's interesting, Bob, what seems to have happened here is that then-Governor George W. Bush was called to jury duty to hear a drunk driving case, certainly not not a capital offense or whatever. In 1996, this person was involved in a drunk driving case at an Austin, Texas strip club. It involved a dancer there. Now, Alberto Gonzalez apparently wrote and told the Senate Judiciary Committee that he did, in fact, escort President Bush, then-Governor Bush, I should say, to the courthouse and supposedly said that the president was prepared to serve on a jury. Now, what apparently happened, according to the judge involved, the lawyer for the dancer, and the prosecutor, is that Alberto Gonzalez allegedly asked for an off-the-record conference, at which point he urged all of them to actually get then-Governor Bush out of jury duty. In other words, to mount some kind of a challenge or whatever that would have him end up not serving. Now, supposedly the reason for this has to do with his having to expose a drunk driving arrest and conviction back in 1976, a conviction that he did not note on his juror form.
Yeah, that'll get a lot of attention this week. I don't think it'll stop Gonzalez from being confirmed, but that's a juicy political story that will raise some questions, because a lot of people have felt like Gonzalez could have been a lot more forthright in his answers before the Senate.
Yeah,
well, that's sort of interesting. Republicans not being forthright in this administration.
But you don't think it's going to stop him? I mean, Gonzalez has said that his spokesperson says he has no recollection of ever asking for a sidebar conference here. Are these three people nuts?
Well, that's a typical Washington response when you get in trouble. No recollection seems to work, as opposed to saying something else. So that's a kind of a Washington tradition, and I think I think that'll continue. That you'll probably hear a lot of those responses over the next week and a half or so.
Is that actually part of policy selective amnesia? what else is going down there in the legislature?
Sure. Well, they're finally actually going to get going. It's been kind of stop and go over the last month, with them coming back and then the electoral count and then inauguration. So now they're gonna push it off, and Republicans want to move a lot of legislation, a lot of stuff that obviously got stuck last year, including energy and tort reform, and obviously the big prize is Social Security reform. But once again, Republicans are kind of having a lot of infighting on that issue. So,
isn't that great? So
the odds are against that bill right now moving, because the Senate Democrats will have no problem blocking that, and I think they're really unified on that issue.
Oh, good. That's good from where we're sitting. And what about the restricting victims' rights legislation?
Well, I don't know how quickly that's going to move, but that's definitely one of the things that's up in both chambers, but I think one of the first things that's going to move is the energy bill, especially moving in the House. They want to move that quickly, and also medical malpractice. That's something the president is consistently bringing up. But once again, the votes aren't there for medical malpractice to move in the Senate. Energy could be a different story, though.
What's in the energy bill?
The energy bill is basically a lot of breaks and tax breaks for industry, and changing to get a little bit more less dependent on foreign oil services. But some senators, including Senator McCain, think it's just basically filled with pork and special interests, and it almost passed the Senate last year. It came within two votes, and it was devastating for Republicans when that did not go through. So that's one of the things they really want to move this year.
Mm-hmm. Bob, what about the agenda of some Republicans on the Hill to start the process of restricting so-called entitlement programs? Mm-hmm. Not just Social Security, but many other entitlement programs. And is it possible that somebody's going to sponsor a bill to actually put a cap on entitlement spending?
There's been a lot of talk from conservatives who felt like over the last 10 years since they took over control of Congress, they've been spending too much money. These entitlements have continued to grow. they want to really put some caps on Medicaid and Medicare spending. Very politically difficult to do, but the conservatives are emboldened by what the, you know, how well they did in the election. So they think if it, this is the time to do it. So they definitely want to curb a lot of those entitlement spending, while also reshaping them and reforming them. But that is high on their agenda.
And what about that bill about bankrupting the government? Are there any progress on that? Bob Cusack, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Bob.
Thank you, guys.
We'll talk to you soon. That was Bob Cusack, managing editor of The Hill. We're going to be back because apparently Donald Rumsfeld is assembling a super secret task force army, guys, who can go out anywhere in the world, do whatever they want at any time. And also we've got Jeff Jarvis coming up, and we've got the Morning Remembrance. It's 42 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Hey, this is Ted Leo, and you're listening to The Spirit of Radio, Mornings Edition on Air America Radio. This...
That song, this band reminds me of Boston. 47 past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Where?
You're right there. I see you. You can't fool me again. I'm not falling for that twice. Right. Hey, I'm not here and you're sitting there.
No. Well, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
I know, man. Every week, Morning's Edition likes to pay tribute to those recently departed individuals who have changed our world forever, but for the most part remain unrecognized. It is to these unknown heroes that we dedicate this, our morning remembrance, with Morning Sedition grief correspondent, Mort Mortensen.
Jay Schulberg, ad agency executive. Jay Schulberg, an advertising executive who created famous slogans for corporate America, including the memorable Got Milk campaign, is dead after years of manipulating people to waste their savings on overpriced crap. Excuse me. A cousin to Bud Schulberg, who wrote the film On the Waterfront, Schulberg had always been an aspiring screenwriter. And until the very end, he never gave up on his dream of finding a producer for his heartfelt story of teen angst, titled, I Can't Believe I Ate the Whole Thing. allergies.
You're right,
man? Can I have a tissue?
Yeah, I'll get you some tissue.
Yeah, thanks.
There you go, man.
Family members would not reveal the exact cause of death, except to say his last campaign slogan was, Got Gout? My eyes are tearing up. It was windy in here. Shut the window, will you? James Griffin, co-founder of the band Bread.
Oh.
This week, the music world received word that James Griffin, founding member of the soft rock group Bread, is toast. In a statement released today to hopeful fans, Griffin's manager said there was no truth to the rumor he's risen. But I guess that news is pretty stale by now.
Oh, no.
Got something in my eyes. Who's chopping onions? Never one to loaf. Griffin helped form Bread in 1968. And after they released the hits Make It With You and Baby I'ma Want You, Bread was on a roll. Any way you sliced it, Bread was hot. There's a cop button over there. Bread made a lot of dough.
Oh, no.
Oh, is there a cat in here? Oh, Griffin had been in good health until last week when doctors labeled his condition as crummy.
Oh, no.
When loved ones discovered his body, witnesses say the former lead singer of Bread was crusty.
Oh, no.
Completely riddled with fungus.
Oh, man.
Nothing could be saved, not even the heels.
Oh.
You bring a ficus plant here?
No, man.
And Mark, you know I'm real sensitive about the pollen. One more paragraph.
Okay, buddy.
Griffin requested his body be interned at the family cemetery, sandwiched in between two graves. evergreens, flowering plants. I'm very sensitive. A lot of suspended particulates in the air this season, right, Mark?
Yeah, I don't know. It's winter, man.
Yeah. I'd just like to say one closing comment.
Oh,
this weekend, a great figure in late night laughter passed away. Of course, I'm talking about Richard Nixon's secretary. Next week, I'll have more on that.
Okay, man.
Thank you.
Okay, buddy.
I've been Mark Morrison saying, who's chopping onions?
All right, man. Thanks a lot, buddy. Why don't you go pull it together?
I'm all right.
Okay, buddy. I think you are. You're gonna just go through the paper now and look for more.
That's right.
Okay, man. Take it easy.
An hour and a half on stage?
Yeah.
Man.
You're gonna come up with me next time. I think we're gonna bring everybody up.
Oh yeah, that'll be fun. Just still make it an hour and a half.
Yeah.
Give those people a break, will you?
They left drained and frustrated.
All right, man. I love you all. I love you, Mark. I love you, Mark, and this guy here, whatever his name is.
See you later, Mark.
All right, bye.
Take care,
Mark.
Bye. What was that?
I quit. That's it. I'm done. The Schulbergs and the Breads and everybody else is going to be coming over here now.
There's something so wrong about it, but it's so funny.
Yeah, it is.
I can't even deal with it. Baby, I'm a want you. Baby, I'm going to need you. You're the only one. What was the other one?
I want to make it with you.
Yeah, and then the guitar man. Baby, he's a guitar man. He can make you laugh.
That was, I must have been listening to James Brown when that one came out.
I'm not proud to know that, but you know why I know that?
Why?
My dad had the 8-track.
You're kidding.
I was like held hostage in a station wagon, and he put the Bread in. He had Mac Davis. He had Bread. But he also had Hocus Pocus by Focus. And also he had Buddy Holly's Greatest Hits and American Graffiti soundtracks. We mixed it up.
All right. Well, Buddy Holly is cool. American Graffiti guy had some interesting stuff on
it. He loved the old songs. My dad was the oldies guy. He's an oldie. So those are, you know, he loved the Stroll by the Diamonds.
Go, let's go stroll.
Yeah. All right, okay, so we're doing stuff. Huh? See what a Dead Bread guy will do?
No, man, I mean, the Stroll was like my song when I was a little kid.
You were, right?
Yeah, because, okay. You know, whenever they had an American Bandstand at one of the Bandstand shows, that was the signature dance.
They
everybody
got right.
The line and the whole thing. Anyway.
Oh, great. So the Pentagon is reaching into the CIA's turf. And saying, we'll take that.
Rumsfeld is saying,
he's going to gut it.
This government is mine.
Mm-hmm.
All mine. Never mind Dick Cheney. Never mind Porter Goss, George W. Bush, a mere bag of shells. I, Donald Rumsfeld, run things here.
The Strategic Support Branch.
Yeah.
Is designed to operate without detection under the Defense Secretary's direct control. The secret support, Strategic Support Branch deploys small teams of case officers, linguists, interrogators, and technical specialists alongside newly empowered special operations forces. So this is an all-out secret army, just about. Am I right, Mark?
Yeah, the Washington Post dropped a bombshell article in yesterday's editions that describes this organization. And what it does is, this is Rumsfeld solidifying his position in the wake of that national intelligence czar thing that the 9/11 Commission recommended. Well, you know, the bottom line for Rumsfeld was, look, I am not going to give up one dime of the $32 billion that I now control. And I'm talking about now $32 billion spent on intelligence in America. It is now controlled by the Defense Department. And under the guise of September 11th, and Mark, we've seen so many things go on under the guise of September 11th, this now, and some people say, under the guise of wanting to make sure that he doesn't have to explain anything, anytime, anywhere to the Congress of the United States, Donald Rumsfeld has set up these little small groups, cadres of military people, whose job it is not just to go out and gather intelligence, but to also hire foreign spies, and to actually conduct espionage under certain circumstances.
There's also little death squad style stuff too. That it's not just intelligence, but it seems like he's, you know, sort of trying to form a sort of black ops. You know, stuff that used to be in the domain of the CIA,
yeah,
which was covert operations and clandestine operations, are now going to be out of the Department of Defense.
And scary enough, this article in the Washington Post says that some of these units have been in operation since 2002. This isn't that new. This is the Strategic Support Branch was begun in April of 2002 as Project Icon.
But I guess the biggest issue is that these all of these operations that are going to be run out of the Department of Defense now, as opposed to the CIA, are not subject to any congressional oversight.
No congressional oversight whatsoever. And this really does, from Rumsfeld's point of view, deal a death blow to the CIA's, because he's setting up organizations and you know, kind of quasi-agencies that roughly parallel the CIA's existing intelligence apparatus, including apparently a training school.
Mm-hmm. So this was, I guess, the biggest fear of the CIA. You know, we knew there was a lot of problems within the CIA because they were sort of like they were used as a scapegoat. Tenet sort of,
yeah,
kissed the administration's butt in terms of...
And got his lips smacked in the process.
Yeah, but it, you know, makes you think that, you know, was it a plan? Are these people as bungling as they thought? Are they just doing blame dispersal? Or did they always want Tenet out? And did they always want to just gut the agency, make, Porter Goss just a signature or a...
figurehead.
A figurehead is what I'm looking for, signature figure. See, my brain's kind of working. It's getting three out of some letters. A figurehead as opposed to somebody that's really overseeing an agency that does anything anymore and just co-opt the entire agency into the Pentagon.
Well, that's what he wants. He wants to make sure that he and only he controls the bulk of the intelligence apparatus and the intelligence money. That's the important
And this
part.
Is a guy taking all these actions when he couldn't even leave the country to go to Germany because they were going to arrest him as a war criminal.
Yeah.
We'll get into that and more about what's going on in the Department of Defense and in the CIA after this. It's time to go over to the top of the hour and listen to a little Brad.
Whoa.
Air America Radio.
So you're...
I'm Mark Maron. It's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians of all kinds, intellectual constitutional plumbers, good morning to you, and constitutional he-men, superheroes, and women, good morning to you folks. We had a call earlier from a cat named Ron out in California, an old activist said we need some constitutional he-men, some intellectuals, some working class, some plumbers to step up and take the reins. That's what we're hoping for, right, Riley?
I'm hoping for it.
I'm sad. Johnny Carson is dead at 79. It's a very sad thing. He was ill. He had emphysema. But the sad thing is that his generation of entertainers is slowly disappearing. And these guys were class acts, my friends. You watch some of those snippets from The Tonight Show if you didn't get to watch as a child, as I did. I mean, I guess he went off. I don't even know. I can't remember what year that he went off the air. I should find that out, but I remember his last show. I remember watching him as a kid. I remember thinking innately that it was a little bit cheesy, but that he was a very, very dignified television personality. There was a classiness to being a broadcaster, and he had great timing. You know what else he was great at, Riley? He's great at tanking. You know, when a joke didn't work, that was where the funny came in when Carson was on the air. And he gave all these comics opportunities. He always made his guests look very good. He was very gracious. He had a lot of humility as a television performer. It's just that you just don't see people like that on television. Like the guy who took his place, Jay Leno, bumbles through everything. He's a very sort of clunky television personality. I mean, he is a personality, but some guys just fit on TV. Mm-hmm. Like Letterman is of that generation too, but he's not. He's younger than Carson, but he obviously is a legacy in the sense that you look at Letterman, just the way that he conducts his show. You know, I mean, Jay Leno turned The Tonight Show into a circus. You know, he comes out, he touches people. It's weird. You know, and the thing is that you know, you watch Letterman, and Letterman, you know, he keeps that theater cold. He keeps it all clean, the streamlined. Even the broadcast looks better than Leno, and you feel like there's a dignity to it, and he fits right on the tube. And there's just so few broadcasters like that. Regis is another one. Regis is a guy who'll sit on that chair, and he's just part of television. There's mm-hmm. no separation between him and the medium, and he brings a certain amount of class to being a broadcaster.
Now, by the way, Carson retired in 1992, which isn't really all that long ago, but did you hear this thing about his writing at some point for Letterman?
Well, I heard that, you know, occasionally he would send in bits. He would send in jokes, and Letterman mm-hmm. would do them. And, you know, and
really?
Letterman's got a lot of writers, but that just came out last week. We were talking about that.
Yeah.
And I assume it was because, you know, I mean, Carson was a very private guy. No one ever knew what was going on with him. You know, I mean, he used to talk on the air about his wives and this and that. But, you know, he had a lot of trouble in his life, and he also was a very private person. And I guess maybe he was lonely, or clearly he was ill. I mean, I know he's had emphysema for a while. It's not one of those things you get overnight and die of.
No.
So he was probably just, you know, trying to keep fresh. I mean, the dude, when he moved from New York to Los Angeles, apparently he used to try his monologues out at the Comedy Store. He had tremendous respect for stand-up.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I was always surprised that Carson never tried to get into film. You know, a lot of times, particularly during, you know, the era that he came mm-hmm. of age, a lot of people went from television into film if they hadn't done film before. But Carson just never seemed particularly interested in film.
I guess there's nothing wrong with knowing your limitations. I mean, and also, Leno's the same way. Leno did a couple of movies here and their bit parts. Bill Maher, too. Bill Maher's another example of a guy who was honoring the legacy of broadcasting. I think more so when he was on network than he was on cable. It's a weird thing with cable. Cable can go either way. I thought that Bill Maher had a certain amount of class when he was on network because mm-hmm. it forced him to work within the context of not using language and not being graphic, you know, dirty or crass in a way. And he was sort of a cad personality anyway. So, you know, pushing that line when he couldn't cuss, I thought was a little more engaging than, you know, actually being able to say whatever the hell he wants sometimes. Just as a broadcaster, and it's weird because I'm saying that as a comic who likes to cuss. And also, I think Jon Stewart honors the legacy of classy broadcasting, just someone who understands the medium and has learned to work within it in a way that he becomes part of the medium. And it just doesn't happen that often. Like Leno,
I thought you hated Jon Stewart.
I don't hate him. I'm just jealous. I'm just a jealous guy.
Only kidding.
Jon Stewart is just, you know, he's Jon Stewart, and, you know, he's tremendously successful. So, you know, like any other entertainer, I have my moments of envy.
Well, Johnny Carson's gone at the age of 79.
That's right.
And, you may be right, Mark, in that an era in television
mm-hmm.
passed with Johnny Carson.
Yeah.
You know, it's never going to go back to the way it was, never.
Well, yeah, there's too much, and there's too much garbage, and it's just, I guess, you know.
But that's true of all American culture, man.
But we were talking about that earlier. It was more intimate when there were fewer outlets. I'm sure Jarvis could approach this. It might be interesting, because Jeff Jarvis is coming in. He's got some things he wants to talk about. But, you know, he seems to be really, a big spokesman for the breaking apart of media into as many factions as possible to get people, you know, into, you know, the dialogue, which I think is true. But I'd like to talk about the impact of, you know, when it was just three or four networks, when it was more consolidated, because we were talking about an intimacy that used to exist, a camaraderie that used to exist among, you know, entertainers that is very old school and that you don't just see anymore. And also, I think, you know, with the number of media outlets, you know, multiplying so much, you know a lot more than you used to about everybody's business. And everybody wants to get involved in everybody else's business. So, you know, there's no mystique anymore. There's no mystery. There's nothing, you know, movie stars used to be like this elevated sort. Now you know everything about them, and all you can do is either hate them or like them. And even if you like them, you're like, yeah, I like them, but they don't deserve that much money. And, you know, he did this, and that's bad. And I don't know.
Because there are 12 different shows on television that show you intimate parts of celebrities' lives.
I always had a problem.
Insider, E.T., The True Hollywood Story, all of these different
scandals.
Yeah. And what they do is bring those celebrities two people in a way that they've become, A, very comfortable with, and in a way that certainly my generation coming up had. I mean, we didn't know into the intimate parts of Betty Davis's life or Barbara Stanwyck's life. Or
unless there was a real scandal.
A real big
scandal. There was always
scandal. When Mitchum got busted for smoking herb, everybody knew about it, apparently. I was too young.
Or somebody gets killed in your yard. You know,
But
I mean, but you're right. I think that they started building those shows. It looked like news shows. It were really just, you know, gossip shows.
Straight straight up.
It's interesting, though, that there was a sort of, even when you watch those old roasts, that there was such a camaraderie amongst all these old cats, and there was such a respect, and they all sort of got in on the joke, and that just doesn't really exist anymore. Let's, you know, when we come back, we're going to get back into it. You know, Donald Rumsfeld taking control of everything secret and dangerous in the world. It's 13 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Who fired these people? Morning Sedition.
It's on record. It's out. It's no secret anymore.
Morning Sedition from Air America Radio.
Having
Eighteen past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yep.
Those of you who don't know, Michael Powell is leaving as FCC.
Start spreading
guy.
The news.
And, you know, we Ramon came in earlier and gave us his Palm Pilot for today, so let's get on it. This is Michael Powell's Palm Pilot, 6:30 a.m. Get into FCC office before everyone else. Quietly remove hidden toilet cams. 7:30 a.m. Clear out desk. Andrew Dice Clay box set. Two live fruit bootlegs. Toilet cam videos. 8:30 a.m. Monitor AM radio for danger words. Focaccia, Shih Tzu, Country Ham, Succotash, Kumquat. 12 noon, have lunch with Howard Stern. Congratulate each other on the greatest public relations fake feud of all time. 2 p.m., work with Dad on vaudeville act called Bush's Biatch, carrying W's water. 4 p.m., call Comedy Central. Agree to be guest of honor at Friars Club Roast. And 6 p.m., hit the deregulate button and run.
There you go.
All right, let's get back into this. Okay, so there's going to be a hearing. McCain, Senator John McCain of Arizona, wants something to be investigated, something to be done about Rumsfeld slowly building a very active, very covert and clandestine and very, you know, globally and beneath the radar of the Congress. He's going to create a military intelligence, you know, army, it seems.
It seems that way. And, of course, John McCain is on the Senate Armed Services Committee. And he doesn't, as he said yesterday, doesn't like to hear about these sorts of things in the Washington Post when they affect a committee that I am a member of,
mm-hmm.
which means he didn't know about all
exactly.
this stuff beforehand. He doesn't think Rumsfeld has broken any laws, but then that's really not the point, is it, Mark?
No.
It is a question of whether or not Rumsfeld is setting up a superstructure that will allow him to evade the law.
Well, that's just it. Is that you have Republicans and Democrats and people of the world demanding accountability on Abu Ghraib, on a lot of other, you know, elements that have occurred during this attack on Iraq, and Rumsfeld's the guy they want to take to task. And this is global and within the government here and within the population here, and he's taking all these moves to never have to be accountable for anything ever.
He doesn't want to be accountable, and he wants to pull the strings, the purse strings and the human intelligence strings. He wants to effectively neuter the CIA. He wants to control, as he has up until now, $32 billion of the $40 billion that's spent on intelligence in this country.
And this is the Strategic Support Branch.
Yeah.
That has actually been in operation since April 25th, 2002, under a different title, Project Icon.
Yeah. Now, this Strategic Support Branch was created by Rumsfeld to provide himself with tools for the, quote, full spectrum of human operations. This is according to the article in the Washington
Post.
Human intelligence operations. In other words, he wants to have, what he's essentially saying is, we don't trust the CIA to be able to develop human contacts in these various hotspots around the world. We're going to do it.
Right.
We don't trust the CIA to pass on information to our military commanders in the field. We're going to do that work. We'll do the passing. We don't trust the CIA because they do have to report to Congress certain things that we don't think they should have to do.
Yes.
So we're going to create these shadow agencies, and we're not going to report to Congress.
Yeah, and that's the kicker right there. And he doesn't, you know, it's not a matter of trust. Ian Rumsfeld wants the power to have all this under his and his underling, Stephen Cambone, who should have been thrown out.
Oh, he should have been gone. He should have been gone a long time ago. But you know what's interesting about this, Mark? This is one of the classic instances of plausible deniability on the part of the Defense Department.
How so?
Here's Lawrence DeRita, Pentagon spokesman,
mm-hmm.
in his carefully worded statement. Quote, "There is no unit that is directly reportable to the Secretary of Defense for clandestine operations as is described in the Washington Post." He also said, quote, "The department is not attempting to, quote, bend statutes to fit desired activities as is suggested in this article," end quote. Now, what he's saying, and it's very interesting how, you know, bureaucrats parse language.
Mm-hmm.
There is no unit that is directly reportable to the Secretary of Defense. That doesn't mean that the unit doesn't exist. Doesn't mean the Secretary of Defense doesn't know what's going on.
Yeah, it's just a built-in blame.
Dispersal
factor.
Unit. Yeah. There you
exactly.
go.
I need somebody to blame in between me and what I'm controlling.
Yeah. Now, it said, he also says, quote, "It is," this is Lawrence DeRita, Pentagon mouthpiece, "it is accurate and should not be surprising that the Department of Defense is attempting to improve its long-standing human intelligence capability."
Do you know the difference between clandestine and covert? Under U.S. law, clandestine refers to actions that are meant to be undetected, and covert refers to those for which the U.S. government denies its responsibility. Now, all under one roof.
That's right. Donald yes. Rumsfeld is the pimp.
Yeah.
The human intelligence is the BH.
There you go. That's Riley's take on the entire thing. Other Rumsfeld goals within this thing is to establish Pentagon's own espionage school. So if you're interested in attending that, go to the Pentagon website, I guess, and say, hey. I want to be a spy.
I feel a job listing coming up.
Establish Pentagon Intelligence Operation Commands for every region overseas. Right now, operation locations for the Strategic Support Branch are, of course, Iraq, Afghanistan, and emerging target countries such as Somalia, Yemen, Indonesia, Philippines, and Georgia. These are, you know, and the guy who's going to be in charge of this, a Reserve Army Colonel, George Waldrop.
He's got problems of his own.
Yeah, but, you know, they it's weird because they talk to people, you know, who have been in this line of duty for a long time and say some of these guys of his generation have not been trained specifically to do the type of work that they're supposed to. You know, he just, I don't know what kind of favor he was owed, but he doesn't seem like the candidate for the gig. Am I right?
No, it doesn't seem as though he has this specific area of expertise. So that does lead to the question of, like, why? Why are you doing this? Now, we also ought to say that... some of what Rumsfeld is attempting to accomplish here, he's doing under cover of some very glaring human intelligence failures, both in the wake of September 11th and in terms of the war in Iraq. They simply didn't have people that knew the languages that were involved in many cases. They didn't have enough people to conduct this kind of intelligence operations in terms of the CIA. So Rumsfeld is kind of sort of jumping into an existing vacuum. You know uh-huh. what I'm saying? He knows that little criticism of the CIA in the 9/11 report gives him the opening to begin to do this sort of thing.
Well, the interesting thing about this guy Waldrop, you know, is that, you know, he was at the INS and he became, you know, he's a mid-level manager and he became embroiled in accusations that he participated in deceiving a congressional delegation about staffing problems at Miami International Airport in June 1995. Now, outside of the rest of his resume, which is relatively unimpressive in relation to the job he's taking, I think this was the thing that really got Rumsfeld interested.
You know, that's exactly what I was going to say. That's what caught his eye.
Deceiving a congressional delegation.
He's a Decepticon. Let's hire him.
Perfect. That's exactly the kind of guy we need to run this thing. He can have a bunch of very experienced covert op guys, black op guys, intelligent guys working up under him, and that's all we need. As long as the guy at the top of the chain can deceive Congress effectively, he knows the kind of, he knows the beat we're going to be walking.
Mm.
So what else has we got on this here? There, now, the other thing, like the whole idea of evading scrutiny is been the kind of trademark of this administration.
Yeah.
I mean, Dick Cheney in terms of policy and Rumsfeld in terms of military operations is that all they do, the entire momentum of the neocon death cult, you know, revolves around, you know, I'm losing words, insulating themselves from criticism from anybody. And
yeah.
keeping things secret, and if it does come out, to make sure that they can somehow get somebody to take the
fall. They're not accountable for anything. It's never their fault. Never.
So this makes perfect sense.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. And Rumsfeld, by the way, as he does this, and as he knew it was going to sooner or later become public, he deflects you know, the actual criticism and accountability that he should be facing over the war in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
Pure and simple.
But, you know, they're going to be dispatching these type of sort of covert operations, Delta Force kind of guys, you know, the Navy SEALs. That's, these are all the guys who are involved.
Yep, and they're all part of that whole, what did they call it, Salvador option?
But they're also here. They're also looking around here. So be careful what you do on your computer. You might get an unwelcome visitor in the middle of the night, or seven of them wearing masks.
Yeah. Jeff Jarvis, BuzzMachine.com, coming up. Talk about the inauguration and much more here on Air America Radio.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley, Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Speaking of that, speaking of the Morning Sedition's book club, I'm Mark Maron, that's Mark Riley, it's 34 past the hour.
Yes, it is.
I'd like to say that you can join the Morning Sedition book club and purchase Sam Lipsight's Homeland, which is our first book in the book club. He's going to be back on January 28th to go over it. That's 4 days. So, you know, you can ask him questions, and if you didn't get it yet, here's a little taste.
We didn't have squash at Eastern Valley. We didn't have tennis either, unless you count that trick with the steel hairbrush and the catgut racket, whereby the butt skin of the weak was flayed.
Yes, the wordsmith and very funny man, Sam Lipsight. Pick up Homeland today, and you still got 4 days to read it. He's coming back. We'll talk to Jeff Jarvis in a second, but let me get this call. It seems to be a weekly thing almost. Pollux is on the line. We've got a call from Pollux, and I must stress it's Pollux with a P.
Yeah, look, Maron, I know where you're headed with this.
Yeah, it's not Bullocks. That's what the British people call
testicles.
Right.
It's what they call testicles.
Yes.
My code name sounds like a name for testicles.
Okay.
Maybe I'm an idiot.
Yes.
Or maybe I'm the only guy who sees the clues about what's really going on.
Okay, I get it, Pollux. What story did we miss this time, my friend?
Do you know about the crows?
Yes, we talked about that. The crows, they suck.
What? Not the black crows. Although, for once, you're right. Now, here's the big story. Scientists, they found that crows on the island of New Caledonia instinctively know how to use tools.
Okay, well, but we should be safe as long as they don't happen to open a Home Depot in New Caledonia. Am I right?
You're right, man. Why don't you talk about airplane food while I try to save some lives?
Mm-hmm.
Right now, the crows, they just use the twigs to dig for food. Don't think these birds can't be weaponized, or worse.
Worse? What's worse than an attack crow, Pollux?
Answer me this, funny man. What happened to the Tasmanians?
I don't know. Were they wiped out by axe-wielding pelicans?
You have no idea how much I hate you. Listen to me.
Yeah.
The Tasmanians had bow and arrow technology.
Okay.
After generations on the island, they lost it, man. Just plain forgot it.
Right.
They were reduced to using spears.
Okay.
Isolated societies actually move backwards in technology.
But Pollux, we're not isolated. With the internet, people are more connected than ever.
You're the tool, Maron. That's why the internet is such a genius thing. It's technology used to destroy technological progress.
Yeah.
It breeds isolation, man. It creates a whole culture of dysfunctional losers leading pointless lives in front of screens full of crap.
All right. So where do the crows come in?
Check out what I found on Google News. Dateline Auburn, New York. This small city near Syracuse is trying to deal with over 60,000 crows who have chosen the town as a convenient place to spend the winter. Officials call the birds a noisy nuisance. Nuisance, the fools!
Pollux, take it easy. It's Syracuse, man. Syracuse.
Exactly! Nobody would suspect that would be the launching off point!
Oh, wait. Hey, this is starting to make sense, man.
It is?
Yeah, government. Let me try and put it together. Government introduced cyber distractions, gradually reduced mankind to a state of helplessness. Meanwhile, starting with the natural tool-using proclivities of crows, scientists selectively breed an avian army skilled in using the advanced weaponry, which is all but useless to debase human society. The advanced divisions of the invasion gather in a nondescript town in upstate New York. Nondescript, yet it's less than 300 miles from all the major industrial centers in the Northeast. 300 miles as the crow flies.
Holy crap!
Hey, Pollux, what's that I hear?
I think it's coming from the radio.
It's not coming from here, man. They're in the house, Pollux.
Oh, man, close the windows.
All right, right now, thank you, Poets. I hope he's okay. In our studio, as usual, once a week, Jeff Jarvis, editor of Buzz Machine. Editor of BuzzMachine.com.
I talk, I don't want to hear who talks funny.
You talk fast, not funny. Former TV critic for TV Guide and also the inventor and creator of Entertainment Weekly. You got some shout out there.
That was nice.
That was nice. They said, what was it, the 20th anniversary?
15. I'm not that old.
15th anniversary of Entertainment Weekly. They said, we'd like to thank Jeff Jarvis for giving us this magazine and be willing not to take any pay for it.
$350 million a year business.
It's theirs.
Wow. But you're not bitter.
Yes, I am. Right, so before you tell.
Yeah. I know there's something going on. So before we get into the inauguration coverage, you know, we were just having this weird conversation, Riley and I, because, you know, R.I.P. Johnny Carson, we were talking about Johnny and what an impact he had on culture and just, you know, what a class act he was in terms of a media personality. And you don't really see much of that anymore. And also, but more specifically, the intimacy of show business at that time. You've watched some of those, the old stuff. Like, there's something that was really lost when it became, you know, more than just four networks.
It changed everything. There was a magical time that's gone. It was only three decades long. Mm-hmm. From the late 50s to the late 80s, we had three networks that killed newspapers, and we had one newspaper towns, and it was one-size-fits-all media.
Right.
And so we all had this grand shared experience that everyone now regrets is gone, and I actually don't, because I think that choice is good. Choice means power.
Sure.
Nonetheless, it was a special time.
Right.
Johnny Carson defined how we told jokes. My father and his friends still tell jokes like Carson did, and my mother and her friends like Lucy did.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Right? You know, we all had a shared experience, and Carson was part of that. And it's over.
Yeah.
It's absolutely over. Now we can go to whatever we want to go to. And that's why, by the way, I agree with you that Jay Leno is just such a bowl of tapioca.
Yeah.
Because he tries to be Carson. He tries to be one size fits all, and that doesn't work anymore.
It doesn't work anymore. And then people try to manufacture the intimacy of what was once show business. I think there were some things lost and some things gained.
Yes.
But, you know, obviously the cultural dialogue was limited then, and it isn't now, but we lose a lot of that intimacy that used to be really human about.
Well, the other thing I'd love to hear you about is I think that Carson, with edgier people out there, made comedy relevant and made comedy newsy.
Sure.
I mean, you know, there was Lenny Bruce out there and there were others out there, but Carson brought it to the mainstream to say, okay, comedy people can have something serious to say.
Right. And actually, Bill Maher, I think, is, you know, stylistically, he does Carson almost in his monologues.
You're right.
If you watch Bill Maher stylistically, a lot of guys really learned how to move on stage, and there was a way that Carson worked around a room that Maher is really a direct legacy of. And I imagine if you ask Bill where he learned that, you know, outside of his HBO specials, but certainly on the old Politically Incorrect show, he does Carson.
Yeah, you know,
he
delivers. That's right.
Well, let's get into the inauguration. You watched it. What were some of the high points?
Wake me up. Well, the first high point, I guess, is that George Bush acted like he actually had a thought. Thought that got quoted. Should we listen to that one?
So it is the policy of the United States to seek and support the growth of democratic movements and institutions in every nation and culture with the ultimate goal of ending tyranny in our world.
Woo! So that
they
had them all corralled too. The entire mall was partitioned into sort of like, you know, little pig tanks.
What's fascinating about that to me is that, well, first off, who's against freedom?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Are you against moral values?
No.
Are you against freedom? Not necessarily. The era of the obvious thought.
Yes.
Yeah.
What was fascinating to me though was that it actually caused some decent discussion afterwards. Uh-oh, is this a doctrine? What do we think about this?
Right, is he saying that we're going to fight tyranny with tyranny?
Well, what are we going to do? What is the formula?
Well, by Friday, they had to issue a clarification because the rest of the world started saying, wait a minute, this means we're no longer going to do business with Pakistan or China or Egypt or many of these other non-democratic countries.
Mark, that's exactly it. And so now media has to keep on Bush, and we got to keep on media to keep on Bush, to say, all right, what does it mean? He said democratic movements, not just countries, movements.
Yes.
All right, hey, I'm starting a democratic movement. You're going to give me some guns? You know, what's happening there? And what was interesting about it was that it was kind of a who can't salute this flag, right? Freedom, right? How you do it is the other question. Zephyr Teach out of the Dean campaign was up at Harvard with me this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
How's that for name dropping? and I like her analysis, so I'll give her credit. She said, well, you know, yeah, I liked what he said. I just don't believe that he can do it.
Well, he said that apparently there was a statement released from the White House. There's not going to be a change in policy. And what were you doing in Harvard?
That was also part of
what
the
what I always do, Mark, blathering about blogs.
So, oh, is that what you...
Yeah,
that
actually
what was the name of the panel?
It was something about journalism and credibility in blogs and things.
And who were the other people on there?
Joe Trippi was there. Mm-hmm. Head of MSNBC was there.
Ron Artest was there.
No.
So you had Joe Trippi, you.
Armstrong Williams? No.
Not him? Where were the brothers on this panel? Artest wasn't invited? Armstrong wasn't invited? I wasn't invited.
Trippi's a jumpy guy. We've had him in here.
Trippi's been, I actually took the train back as we avoided the blizzard. I spent the whole train ride with him back. And
oh, my God.
Changed the world.
Wait a minute. Were you on the same train as Marin?
Can you imagine a conversation between him and Trippi? Man,
oh, yeah.
You probably were fueling the engine of the
next
train.
Next stop, Penn Station.
Caffeine, more caffeine, please.
We're gonna come back and we're gonna hear a kind of funny, and let's see how Wolf Blitzer handled the coverage in a second. We're with Jeff Jarvis from Buzz Machine, 43 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on the air and online at morningsedition.com from Air America Radio.
All right, let's get this thing on the ground here. 48 past the hour, Mark Maron, that's Mark Riley. Jeff Jarvis from BuzzMachine.com is our guest.
Yeah.
We're talking about the inauguration, so let's move into some of the deeper analysis from Wolf Blitzer. This is some rich stuff, man. I had to play it over a couple of times just to get it through my head.
Where there's wolf, there must be war, right? You
know? That's true.
Yeah, it's the most insipid event every 4 years. Right.
Yeah.
The Golden Globes is more spontaneous than the inauguration.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing happens.
Nope.
Well, everything's on lockdown this time.
Yeah, especially. I mean, it's we don't have queens, and if we did, their grandsons would be wearing swastikas, so it's a good thing.
Yeah.
You know, we don't coronate people. We don't believe in that. It's just a guy in the office.
They definitely coronated this guy.
Yeah, sure did.
So what are they going to have to talk about, right?
Yeah.
They got nothing to talk about. So
right.
Poor Wolf Blitzer is there having to do happy talk about the inauguration. Let's listen to that.
Once again, this is the brand new presidential limo that's driving down Pennsylvania Avenue, heading up to Capitol Hill. And this first day on the job for this limo, Ari Fleischer, looks like a pretty impressive car.
Well, they're all pretty impressive, although I'll tell you, if you're fortunate enough to ever get to ride in the back of it, you really want to know that it's much different. It's got a bench in the back. There's another one that faces that bench. It sits six people rather comfortably.
Wow!
But other than that, other than you can't play with the windows yourself, it looks like a regular car.
What do you mean? You say you can't play with those? You can't open and close the windows?
He has to ask somebody in the front seat to do that for him, the Secret Service style.
Because it's armored. Is that?
Normally,
in the armored kinds of cars, you can't really open
We're getting to the bottom of this.
You can't really control much from where he's sitting.
Still an airtime.
He'll never get out of that vehicle unless the Secret Service agent actually goes to the outside and opens the door for him. But
what about the radio? Can he flip radio stations?
Do they have Sirius?
He can put on ESPN radio anytime he wants.
He's got satellite radio, I'm sure.
We can do an in-depth report on whether there's a DVD player, satellite radio, and OnStar navigation.
Yeah, I'm sure they have
thing.
All that kind of cool stuff in that car.
Wow, cool stuff. Wolf Blitzer gets to
Gadget Man.
Maybe someday Wolf will get to ride in a big limo.
Is that what you call reporting?
Hey, Jeff, I bet you there were people calling as he was speaking. Say, hey, you gotta turn on Blitzer. You got to turn on CNN. They're talking about the limo.
People do like that kind of stuff, but I know that's what you call filling time.
That's all they could do. Right?
You know,
they
could have actually sort of raised some questions about, you know, what's really going on, what's happening in the world, how
this
relates to the
but
world.
But no, we have George Bush is walking out of the White House. He's walking into the church. He's walking out of the church. I guess after West Wing, it is news when the president walks.
Right.
But, you know, it's just incredibly insipid. And
but this is marked a deterioration of journalism. It's not that there's nothing to talk about.
Well, there's a bigger issue here. Should there be all-day coverage of the inauguration?
No,
what does
it
say?
There should be hardly all... There's very few things that demand all-day coverage.
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
The speech is, what, 17 minutes long. That's the only attempt at substance.
We didn't cover it at all.
Attempt. Good for
no.
you.
But we did the ignore
But when Hillary's elected, you'll cover it, I know.
When Hillary's elected, if that happens, my friend,
it's a
we'll be standing
off,
behind her, the two of us, behind the day. Hey, it's us.
Well, Trippy and I worked on that on the train.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, well,
did you get it hammered out?
Yeah.
They're the ones that got us the invite to Terry McAuliffe send-off.
Yeah, thanks, buddy.
Thanks, Jeff.
Yeah. So what, in your read of this, I mean, what is crumbling here? What is wrong? Do you think it's just that they spend all day covering this?
Yeah, it becomes dutiful television. It becomes this belief that it's the inauguration, so we all have to be there with the full knowledge that nothing is going to happen. Why do you have to be there? You're right, Mark. You could instead have a great all-day debate about policy and about the things that should happen and shouldn't happen in the next 4 years.
But that would involve engaging Democrats, which they don't really like to do these days.
I had a question about the inauguration that no one was able to answer, and no one can answer to this day.
I'm going to answer it right now.
Why is it that the Crawford, Texas High School Band was on a float and everybody else had to march? Can you answer me that?
Texas sissies.
Yeah, that's what I want to know.
I'm thinking maybe they got connections, you know, maybe I don't know. What's your answer
was
to
it? Built
I have no answer. I have no answer. But the president's hometown high school band did not have to march. What? All they did was sit on the back of a flatbed.
In the spirit of what he did most of his
youth. Girly men.
They're Republicans, they have no rhythm. They can't march in time.
No, in the spirit of his youth, maybe he's just sort of like, take it easy, don't work too hard, you'll get further.
Yeah, well, you know, he was like, you know, giving the big thumbs up and waving and applauding.
I know, he was dancing and stuff. It made me irritated.
What you have to is you have this effort to say, Palazan agreed that it's a majestic day. Larson said he heard that Dan Rather was almost teary-eyed. I mean, come on!
A majestic day?
It's not a majestic day. It was colder than Karl Rove's heart. That's all it was. You know, it was just chilly. That's what the kind of day it was. With a bunch of stuff. The best moment, the best worst moment, mm-hmm. the horrible bad moment,
yeah.
was a veteran of the Lawrence Welk show singing John Ashcroft's song.
Covering Ashcroft.
Ooh.
That's just the idea of that is bad.
Oh.
I'll tell you what the best moment was, though. Yeah. There was a guy, and this was, I guess, only on C-SPAN, but there was a guy who was cleaning up after the road apples in the street. And he actually got a round of applause from the police.
Well, if the president gets whoops for foreign policy, woo!
Yeah,
I guess that
works. We decided that the guy cleaning up the road apples, getting applause and waving, was really the only guy that most people could identify with,
yes.
either metaphorically or literally.
Or otherwise, yeah.
Interestingly, this is where media is really going here. CNN lost 63% of its audience from the last inauguration. Guess who got it?
Who?
Fox. Fox was 2.4 million, up 57% over 01. CNN was 1.3 million, down 14% primetime. This is primetime now.
So you're saying that most of the people that watched it on CNN now watch it on Fox because that's the Republican outlook.
Well, the same thing that happened during the convention.
Okay.
Right? During the Democratic convention, Fox's ratings weren't as high. During the Republican convention, they were skyrocketing. Right?
Well, you know, when it comes to an inauguration, it's when you call it a celebration, you know, who else are they going to watch?
Because they want to see a chain once we celebrate it. They
of
don't
course.
Want
to that's the future of media here. That's
yeah.
So, you know, in that sense, fine. You know what? Fox, your boy, your day, you do the inauguration. Everybody else is going to have Oprah. You know, why make a sham of it?
When you say the future of media, you mean completely biased outlets
yes.
of media?
That, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. At Harvard.
But doesn't that trickle all the way down?
Yeah, it does.
Not
down to us, it doesn't.
Of course it does.
Of course it does.
I mean,
you are leading.
Lies! I'm a journalist, damn it!
But I mean, that goes across the board. This is one of the liabilities of this freedom that you talk about.
I don't think so, because I think it actually means more discussion of more people by more issues, and that's a good thing in the long run. We're just not honest about it now. We're lying about it now.
We still have these
discussions about objectivity when, you know, Fox News is Fox News.
Yeah, but isn't that the same with anybody? Can't people sort of choose and select the truth that they want to, or what they think is the truth, and just commit to that and commit to that outlet without having any real barometer of whether or not has any credibility?
Especially with TV, yes. I will argue, as I do defending the web, that the web actually links you to the argument to say, this is what I disagree with.
Mm-hmm.
But on TV, yes, it's a fire hose into your brain.
Okay.
Ooh.
You know?
Sure.
You like that?
Ears are wet.
That's what they design it for. They just blast it into your head.
Yeah.
No, I see what you're saying, Jeff. And as always, engaging to talk to you, Jeff Jarvis from BuzzMachine.com. And congratulations on the 15th year anniversary.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. The beard is whiter. The pocket is emptier.
All right.
Are we paying him?
Oh, I'm sorry. Here's the
no.
Here comes the facts from the Streisand compound. Here's the liberal agenda today. Here are your marching orders. One, new chairman of the FCC, Larry Flint.
Yay!
Two, praise Donald Trump for his wife recycling program. Three, make effort to keep secret SpongeBob's recent appearance at GLAAD and ACT UP meetings. Four, now that Bush's second term is underway, let's forge as many documents as possible. Five, today's phrase, just drop it into conversation. 2 days into Bush's second term and we get 15 inches of snow. Do the math, sheeple. He'll stop at nothing. Wake up. All right, thanks again, Jeff. Mark, what's happening tomorrow, man?
Tomorrow we're going to talk to two Oscar-nominated filmmakers about a film that I know quite a bit about.
Okay.
Because it's called Asylum. It's about female genital mutilation.
That's good breakfast stuff.
Well, we're not going to get into that part. We're going to get into one woman's story.
No, I know.
Who managed to escape.
I don't mean to mock it. I'm very interested to hear about it because I don't know much about it.
And you know what else? We're going to be talking to our good friend, Babak Desgafache, Newsweek Baghdad correspondent. We're going to get more on Iraq tomorrow as well. Jeff, thanks a million. Marin, it's been fun.
Has been. I'll see you tomorrow, buddy.
See you tomorrow. Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition, delivering you from evil in 3 hours or less on Air America Radio.